In the last session, we were, in terms of the Vipassana practice, we were saying that at the foundation level of Vipassana practice, we use these four applications of mindfulness to investigate the body, feelings, mind, and phenomena in general, to come to insight into these, into the body, feelings, mind, and phenomena. And the insights that we're cultivating here are impermanence, dukkha, and no self. And at the beginning phase, to really emphasize the impermanence. And that's what we did in last session in the meditation. So that's what I'd like to do, begin again this session with another Vipassana meditation, focusing on the body. This time, I'm not going to guide the scan. You'll do your own guiding in terms of the scan. Just a couple of tips with that. First is go at your own speed. So in the last meditation, we went quite slowly. What I would recommend is to, when you get to a part of a body and you notice some sensations, then just move on to the next area. If you get to an area in the body and you don't notice any sensations, stay there a little bit longer. And then when you notice, start to notice sensations, then move on to the next area. Or if you, but don't stay there for the whole session if you don't notice anything. Eventually move on anyway if you don't notice anything. Or if you get to a part of the body and you notice some very heavy sensation, stay there also a little bit longer and see if it changes. In terms of the order, you don't have to use the same order. So I just use from the top down and then from left to right. So if you want to go right, left, that's okay. So you can pick your own order. So if you scan and you end up scanning a little bit quickly, more quickly, because you can do that comfortably, when you're finished, then start again. So just scan again. Okay? So let's do the meditation. Keeping the back nice and straight. And allowing the body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. Using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. And also keeping the body as still as possible, avoiding any unnecessary movement or fidgeting. Allowing the breathing to flow naturally and effortlessly. And with each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen. And allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. So having prepared body and mind, we can now begin Vipassana practice. Again, observing the field of the body, gaining insight into the body. So once again, scanning the body from the crown of the head to the tips of the feet. Observing sensations in every part of the body, observing them arise and pass. And you can scan at your own speed and in the order that you prefer. So we've briefly talked about the three turnings of the wheel, where the Buddha taught different ideas, particularly about nature of reality. And we saw from those three turnings of the wheel how the four philosophical schools evolved, that from the Four Noble Truths teachings, we have initially the Vaibhashika system being formulated, and then later the Sautrantika philosophical system evolving. And that from the second turning of the wheel, we have the Majjhimika philosophical system evolving, particularly through Nagarjuna from the second century. And the third turning of the wheel, we have the Chittamatra or mind-only system evolving, roughly beginning the fourth century from great Indian master Asanga. So let's see how those turnings of the wheel and the philosophical systems then spread to the various countries. So initially when Buddhism spread from India, the main teachings that were spreading were the Four Noble Truths teachings, and they were spreading through the Pali language. And when then Buddhism spread, it spread initially to Sri Lanka. And then also up through the northeast, through Burma, Laos, Cambodia, Thailand. And so in these traditions now, modern-day traditions, collectively, they're often referred to as the Theravada traditions, and really they're rooted in the foundation teachings of the Four Noble Truths. Then, as Buddhism started to evolve more in India, we have more, particularly in the area around the Nalanda Monastery in that area of India, we have a lot of the teachings from the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras and the Third Turning of the Wheel really starting to take hold in India. And it was at that time then Buddhism spread up through the northwest of India, what's now Afghanistan, Pakistan, over the Himalayas onto the Silk Route. And at that time, Sanskrit was used a lot as the language for the teachings. And it spread onto the Silk Route and went across into China, Korea, Japan, Vietnam. And then also a little bit later, beginning about the 8th century, again it spread over the Himalayas and this time into Tibet from the 8th century onwards. And these traditions collectively are referred to as the Mahayana traditions because they include a lot of the Perfection of Wisdom teachings, Third Turning of the Wheel, where the goal of the spiritual path is enlightenment, full enlightenment, hence the term Mahayana. When Buddhism spread into Tibet, initially in the 8th century, the teachings that came in formed the basis of the initial school within Tibetan Buddhism. So there are four schools within Tibetan Buddhism. The first school is called the Nyingma school. It's a Tibetan word, literally means old school or original school. And then after the time when this was starting to develop in Tibet, Buddhism was afterwards sort of persecuted. The king at the time tried to wipe out Buddhism and it sort of went a little bit underground for a couple of centuries. And then again around the 10th, 11th century, another wave of Indian masters came into Tibet to re-establish Buddhism in Tibet. And through their efforts, we have the other three schools being formed. Which is the Kagyu school, the Sakya school, and the Gelug school. Collectively, these are called the Sama schools, and Sama means new schools. So they started to develop from the 11th century onwards in Tibet. Now, in terms of tenets, all the four schools of Tibetan Buddhism, the actual tenet system that they follow is the Majjhimika philosophical system. And within that, we saw those two sub-schools of Svatantrika and Prasangika. Prasangika is the one that they follow within all the four schools as their tenet system. So then the question can be is, why then, because of course this centre is part of FPMT, which is belonging to the Gelug school of Tibetan Buddhism, why are we bothering to look at these other schools? Why don't we just try and understand the Prasangika system? Because if that's the one we're trying to follow, why don't we just understand that and forget about the others? And the answer is that this Prasangika view is very subtle, very difficult to understand and appreciate. And the other three philosophical systems, plus the Svatantrika Majjhimika philosophical system, are like rungs of a ladder. They're like stepping stones to help us to get to this view. And to really help appreciate what I mean by that, we can talk about what's called the two extremes. The two extremes of existence and non-existence. Sometimes it's called, the existence is sometimes called eternalism or permanence or given a couple of other names, and the extreme of non-existence of nihilism. And what these two extremes really are, and here of course we're talking about extremes in terms of our view of reality. Of course, within Buddhism, we can talk about extremes in other ways. We can talk about, of course, in meditation, the two extremes of dullness and distraction, you know, and there's other ways we can talk about extremes. But here we're talking about in terms of philosophical view. And what the two extremes really are is this extreme is an extreme of what's called superimposition. Which means what we are doing, and this is the one we most often fall to rather than this one, is we are superimposing, meaning we're adding something on top of reality, either with respect to ourselves or the world of our experience. We are superimposing a level of existence that doesn't exist. And so what we've touched on very briefly in these two philosophical schools we're looking at this weekend, the superimposition, the thing which we're laying on top, is the idea of a self, this idea of Atman. We are superimposing that we exist in this very solid way as a self. So that's what this extreme of existence is. It's where we superimpose, we're adding something that doesn't exist. The extreme of non-existence is something, the other word in superimposition here is deprecation. And what we mean by this is deprecation is we are taking away something that exists. We are deprecating or denying something that actually exists. So here, of course, with respect to person, the superimposition is we are superimposing this idea of self or Atman on the person. And here, a deprecation would be to say that there's no person at all. The person doesn't exist at all. So this is a deprecation. It's a denying of something that actually exists. So in all of these philosophical schools, we are trying to avoid these two extremes. We're trying to find the middle way. So even though the fourth school is called Majjhimika, which it means middle way. In fact, all of the four schools are trying to find their middle way between these two extremes, to really find how we exist and the world around us exists. Now, we can look at this using a chart to really help appreciate the point of this. So you've got a chart called Avoiding the Two Extremes. So let's start with Vaibhashika. So this is the extreme of existence and extreme of non-existence. So they posit these two extremes and what the middle way is. And they, in this chart here, we see that how they avoid the extreme of permanence or existence is that they say all conditioned phenomena are impermanent. That's how they avoid that. And how they avoid the extreme of non-existence is all phenomena are substantially established. That's the level of existence they have. So that's how they say avoiding these two extremes. But then if we go to the Sautrantika system, what they're saying is how to avoid the extreme of permanence is permanent phenomena are not substantially established. So what they're saying is, effectively, what the Vaibhashika is saying is the middle way is actually the extreme of permanence, or the idea that things are substantially established. So what has happened is when we move from Vaibhashika to Sautrantika, they've moved the goalposts, they've moved where the two extremes are. So for Sautrantika, what Vaibhashika says is the middle way is they're saying, no, that's the extreme of permanence, and the extreme of nihilism is down here. So middle way is here. I mean, this is a gross simplification, but essentially they've moved the goalposts of the two extremes. So what the Vaibhashikas are saying is the middle way, they're saying that's the extreme of permanence. And effectively what the Vaibhashikas are saying is nihilism is the middle way for them. So they've moved it over. And if we look at Chittamatra, we have the same, is that the Sautrantikas say how to avoid what their middle way is objects are natural basis for names and conception. What that really means, we're going to look at actually next weekend, so don't worry about it now. But then the Chittamatrans say to avoid the extreme of permanence, objects are not natural names, basis for names and conceptions. So again, what the Sautrantikas say is the middle way, the Chittamatrans say that's the extreme of permanence. So then the Chittamatrans have moved the goalposts even further down. And then if we keep looking at Svartantrika and Prasangika, we have the same idea, that the Svartantrikas are moving down and then the Prasangikas are down here. So what we're seeing is that we're moving what they claim to be the middle way to more and more subtle level of understanding. And so therefore, we are probably somewhere up here now. We're grasping onto things really being solid and real. And when we look at the Prasangika view, this is their idea of nihilism, of non-existence, and this is the middle way for them. But if we're way over here in our current view, and we look at this Prasangika view, this middle way and nihilism from that perspective, it's hard to distinguish because they're both so far from where we are now. Therefore, as I mentioned earlier, even some very intelligent modern-day philosophers who read Nagarjuna's work, which is on Prasangika, they say that Nagarjuna is a nihilist because from their view, what they're saying here is the same as this. It's hard to distinguish this because we're way over here somewhere. So therefore, if we can really appreciate the other philosophical systems' views,
we can move our goalposts from here to here to here to here. And then when we look at prasangika, we can already be somewhere down here in our understanding. And then the difference between our understanding and the middle way is not so different. And it's much easier to see that without falling to the extreme of nihilism.
Is that clear? I mean, what the details of the different assertions we're going to look at, of course.
Just one other thing on that. So, therefore, for Vaibhashikas, when they look at the other school's views, the Vaibhashika would say all the other schools are nihilists. The Saitrantikas would say the Vaibhashikas are falling to this extreme, whereas the other schools, Chittamatra and Madhvika, are nihilists. The Chittamatras would say that both the Vaibhashika and Saitrantika are eternalists, and the Madhvika is a nihilist. And within Majjhimika, the Svatantrikas would say everyone else is an eternalist, the Prasangika people, they're nihilists. Prasangika are saying all the other schools are eternalists. So they're all claiming, of course, they've got the right view, and the other four philosophical systems are either eternalists or nihilists. Similarly,
there's another chart I want to go to. Just opposite that, the classification of tenet systems. Because we can also talk about non-Buddhist tenet systems and Buddhist tenet systems. So from a Buddhist perspective,
non-Buddhist tenet systems also are falling to the two extremes. So that's what we see here. Non-Buddhists, sometimes they're called outsiders. From a Buddhist perspective, those non-Buddhist tenet systems are falling to either of these two extremes. We see here proponents of a view of permanence, proponents of a view of annihilation or nihilism. And this was prevalent even at the time of the Buddha, these other ideas. A lot of these non-Buddhist ideas. And one of the most prevalent is the first one, this falling to the extreme of existence or eternalism, this idea of superimposing. There were a number of philosophical systems, even at the time of the Buddha, that superimposed onto person an idea of self, a self that had three properties.
The wording they use here are permanent. Okay.
Is that a number of these other non-Buddhist philosophical systems at the time were saying that the person existed in this way, as a self, that it was permanent, meaning unchanging, it was unitary, meaning having no parts, and was completely independent of everything else. So from a Buddhist perspective, this is a superimposition. This is a belief in something or adding something that doesn't exist on top of how the person actually exists. Question? So all as we're going to see actually a little bit later when we get into the tenet systems, all Buddhist tenet systems would reject this. No. What we're going to see is that the superimposition, the adding, we can do at many levels. This is at a very coarse level, but And from a Buddhist perspective, this is something that we would only do through wrong intellectual thinking. It's not something we instinctively do. Whereas the self that the Vaibhashikas and Sautrantikas are mainly pointing at is a little bit more subtle idea than this. We're coming to that. But that's also something we instinctively do. That's a different idea of self than this one. Yeah. That's what the Prasangikas would say. And that's something we're going to see in these two tenet systems this weekend, is that from a Prasangika perspective, saying that things do not exist from their own side is that their view. But what we're going to see is that the lower tenet systems don't see any contradiction in those statements. Yeah. Whereas the lower schools would say, no, things can be impermanent and they can be truly existent. There's no contradiction there at all. The lower systems would say that. Prasangika would say exactly that. If you really look at impermanence and really understand what it means at the subtlest level, it has to mean that. But the lower systems say there's no contradiction. All the lower systems say everything's impermanent, yet if it truly exists, it exists from its own side. They don't say, there's no contradiction there, according to them.
Unitary and the Titimati view of non-duality, mental of self and objects, sound remarkably similar.
Unitary here just means no parts. It doesn't mean duality. That's a different idea. So this just means no parts. Non-duality means no subject-object duality. So that's a little bit different idea than unitary. So unitary here is not the same word as one nature. Unitary means it's not talking about, because what you're talking about there, non-duality, is how things exist. This is talking at a conventional level. Does it have parts or not? That's all.
On that point, I wanted to read from this book here, Buddhist Philosophy, just to summarize a little bit what we've been saying here. This is on page 23. He says, "It is fascinating to consider the criteria by which one school is, quotes, better than another. They are not in order of founding, for instance, as we might expect. To be sure, the Vaibhashika school, the main type of which was the Savastivada, does predate the arising of Mahayana tradition and the founding of Majjhimika school, which can be roughly placed in the first century. However, the Sautrantikas and Chittimatrans rely upon works written in the 4th and 7th centuries. Rather, as indicated in the last chapter, the schools are arranged according to their approach to the, quote, middle way of denying the extremes of permanence and annihilation. Each succeeding school includes more in what is regarded as permanent and less in what is regarded as annihilation. Roughly, we move gradually from radical substantiality to radical insubstantiality as we go from Vaibhashika to Prasangika. At the one end, Vaibhashikas call ultimate truths the substance particles out of which they say all things are built. They have substantial existence, by which they mean they can be perceived without depending on anything else. At the other end, Prasangikas say that nothing substantially, truly, inherently, or ultimately exists. Um, Absolutely nothing has anything other than a mere nominal imputed interdependent existence, even the ultimate truth of all things. So that's what we can see, is that these philosophical systems are sort of moving from really more substantial to less substantial. And by understanding each of these schools and where their middle way is, really helps us to come to better appreciate the Prasangika view, which we're going to be looking at next weekend. So if we look at this chart here, and we look at the Buddhist tenet system, just to review this before we actually now begin the tenets text. As we saw briefly this morning, the Buddhist tenets we can divide into two. Those who propound true existence, assert the existence of truly existent things, and then the Majjhimika, which refute true existence. So remember, true existence means existing in the same way in which it appears. The phenomenal world appears to exist independent of us. If it exists in that way, it would be true. And the lower two schools of Vaibhashika Sautrantika accept that there is an independent objective world there, a truly existent world. Even the Chittamatran, who reject that, still accept the mind is truly existent, because everything's coming from the mind. So the mind really does exist as it appears, to exist from its own side, to be truly existent. So they are also said to be proponents of true existence. Even though they don't accept a truly existent external world, they do accept a truly existent mind. Whereas the Majjhimika philosophical system, which we're looking at next weekend with the Chittamatra, reject that. And so we see that the Vaibhashika Sautrantika, it says here, adhere to the true establishment of external objects, and the Chittamatra adhere to the true existence of the internal mind. And in the Majjhimika, they refute true existence. And there's a subtle difference between Svatantrika and Prasangika, which we won't go into here. We'll look at that next weekend. Okay, so based on that, any last questions? Otherwise, we'll start to look at the tenets text. Okay, so let's go to the tenets text. So, presentation of tenets. So remember, the text we're following is by Jetsun Chögyi Gyaltsen from the 15th, 16th century. And again, he was the textbook writer for the Sarah J. Monastic College within the Gelug School of Tibetan Buddhism. And so if we look at the first page, he starts with a homage, and he's particularly paying homage to Manjushri. And of course, Manjushri is the symbolism of wisdom. So a lot of the tenets here, of course, is about developing wisdom, particularly the wisdom of reality. So therefore, he's paying homage to Manjushri in relation to that. And here it says there are three outlines. There's the definition, divisions, and meaning of each division. So in the definition, it says a definition of a person who propounds Buddhist tenets is a person propounding tenets who asserts the three jewels to be the final objects of refuge and who does not accept any objects of refuge other than these. So this is the sort of normal classical way of defining whether someone's Buddhist or not, is if they go for refuge to the three jewels. So, of course, the three jewels are Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And often the analogy given here to describe the three jewels is that the Buddha is like the doctor, the Dharma is like the medicine, and the Sangha is like the nurses who help us to recover from some illness. So
the normal way of measuring whether we're Buddhist or not is if we go for refuge to the three jewels. That if we want to overcome problems and suffering in our life, who do we turn to? If we return to the Buddha as the teacher, the Dharma as the medicine, and the spiritual community to help support us in that practice, then we can be said to be a Buddhist. And that's how it's defined here. But I think there's another way of whether we are Buddhist or not, which is probably more related with respect to the tenets here when we're talking about philosophical tenets. Because we can talk about being Buddhist by going for refuge to the three jewels, and that we can say to be a Buddhist in terms of our conduct. But also we can talk about being Buddhist in terms of our philosophical view, which I think very much relates to this tenets text. So to be a Buddhist in terms of philosophical view, we can be said to be a Buddhist in terms of our philosophical view if we accept what's called the four seals. The first of the four seals is all compounded phenomena are impermanent. A compounded phenomena is any phenomena that is created by causes and conditions. So this is the first statement, is that anything produced with causes and conditions is impermanent, meaning changing moment by moment. So this is the first of the four seals. The second statement is all contaminated phenomena are suffering. And here the word suffering is a translation of dukkha. Contaminated phenomena, the word contaminated here means contaminated by the mental afflictions. So what this is really talking about is all of our experiences that are under the influence of mental afflictions and ignorance, is that they are in the nature of dukkha. So this is basically talking about the first noble truth. The third statement is all phenomena are empty and selfless. How to interpret these words, empty and selfless, as we're going to see, varies from one of between each of the four philosophical schools in Buddhism. But all of these four philosophical schools accept this statement interpreted in it in a certain way. And then the last statement is Nirvana is peace. And here the word peace means Nirvana is a state, peace or pacified of all mental afflictions and suffering. So these are the four seals. And as we're going to see, all four Buddhist tenet systems accept those statements. Particularly this one they interpret slightly differently, but they accept those statements. And so we as an individual, if we accept those statements, we can be said to be a Buddhist in terms of our philosophical view. Any questions about any of those statements?
Different schools have also different ways in the Nirvana peace, because obviously arriving to that
Of course, all the philosophical schools say that when we achieve the state of nirvana, we are completely liberated from all suffering and its causes. Of course, what we're going to see is that within those different philosophical systems, there are different assertions as to what we need in terms of vipassana practice to achieve that state. And that's very much related to this point here. Anything else? Of course, very simply, we can even see that these first three are the three marks of existence that we've looked at from the first turning of the wheel: impermanence, dukkha, and no self. And this is the goal of the three marks of existence. So we can see that even, you know, at the foundation level, which we're following this week in the Four Noble Truths, then within that, certainly these are all accepted. Okay, yeah. So, in terms of Mahayana, which is coming next weekend, they would also accept this, because here we're saying that nirvana is a state free of all mental afflictions and suffering. So they would certainly accept that, even though in the Mahayana, for them, this is not the final goal, that there is a further goal, but they would still accept this. And also, in the Mahayana, this word nirvana can also be used when talking about enlightenment. Often we hear, we talk about two types of nirvana in the Mahayana, and one is called non-abiding nirvana. And that's just another word for enlightenment. So you could also interpret it that way. But I think it's a very simple way. Also in the Mahayana, the same goal of nirvana is a state free of suffering and its causes. They would also accept that, of course. Okay, let's take an afternoon tea break and come back at 3:30. And we'll have a look at the Vaibhashika system. And we'll start to look at it.